Everyone, welcome to the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It's Wednesday, May the 12th, 1999. We're here today for an informational meeting on an overview of the new Caressa grounding. And, of course, this has been a major issue for the legislature as we've watched what has happened, and those of us particularly who have coastal districts, and a great dispute, of course, erupted between Senator Tarno and I as to whose part was where. And that sort of thing, reflecting our two districts and where the new Caressa was and what part was in what area. What we're going to do right now, Langdon, I'm going to ask you to come up with a group you had, and I'll let you folks begin first. Department of Environmental Quality, and I think you had five people that were up here earlier. We'll have you take the two or three in the center and one on each side on the outside microphone. And okay. And of course, everyone will identify yourselves for the record. We did ask for the cameras tonight because some of our committee members are not present, and we wanted to be able to make sure that they could see what happened. And one of the things we talked about before we began was to have a kind of the chronology of what happened and when, and the environmental conditions that our folks were facing as they looked at this disaster. And so with that, I'll let you begin. I'll let you determine who's going first, state your name for the record, and begin. By the way, welcome again.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, I'm Langdon Marsh, Department of Environmental Quality Director.
Senator Commander Dwayne Kennedy, I'm with the Marine Safety Office in Portland, Oregon, Coast Guard.
And I'm Bill Milley. I've been representing the shipowner throughout this incident.
Great. And one thing, if I could ask you, this room is renowned for this problem. In fact, you see me leaning towards the mic, and that is you need to get close to the mic, particularly where we will be picking it up for the tape. And so, as each one of you speak, well, go ahead and put that mic up close. Jenny Gleeman, you're here. We were looking for you earlier. Mics on the edges are good. If you'd like to,
I'm going to the far left end for that workshop.
Actually, depending on where you are, it looks like right to me.
I guess I apologize. We're on the floor up there, and time got away from me. For the record, Representative Mike Lehman, State Representative District 47, which includes the first home of the whole new Caressa and the continuing home of the back part of the new Caressa. Several weeks ago, or a month ago, I guess, the governor appointed a task force to look into basically what went on with the new Caressa. I'm trying to find in my packet here the people appointed to the task force. Off the top of my head, I can tell you with myself, Senator Tarno, Representative Thompson, Gene Cowan, who is the county commissioner for Lincoln County, Joanne Virgin, who is the mayor of Coos Bay, Jack McGowan, who is the executive director of SOLV, Alan Rumbaugh, who is the general manager of the Port of Coos Bay, Nick Furman, who is the executive director of the Oregon Indigenous Crab Commission, and Fran Recht, who is the program manager for the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Basically, this task force was formed to accomplish several things. First of all, to attempt to give a good public overview as to what occurred, you know, to shine the light of day on what occurred, not that there's anything to be hidden, not that anybody's hiding anything, but just to bring it out, go through the whole process. There are a lot of questions being raised, a lot of questions being asked. Frankly, a lot of those questions are being answered very simply and very quickly when you get the experts in to do it. The other thing was to look at what things state agencies and state government needs to do to attempt to address the issues that cropped out of the new Caressa. And thirdly, are there any recommendations we need to make to the federal government in to issues they deal with, particularly the maritime navigation, issues like that. We've had our first meeting on the coast, and it was about a half-day meeting. It was basically a get-acquainted meeting. All of us were there trying to, you know, just to set out the agenda where we're going. The next meeting, I believe, is May 20th, 24th. 21st, it's in Coos Bay. is scheduled for an all-day meeting. Essentially, the format is going to be a morning session, bringing in all the people that were involved and essentially going through what you just described earlier, a chronological step-by-step as to what occurred. Then the afternoon session is going to be open to public input, anybody that wants to come forward and talk about it. We anticipate having in June sometime another meeting in Walport or Newport that follows the same basic format, bringing again the morning people or the people that were directly involved or experts, and then the afternoon being reserved for people for public input. We anticipate a couple of more meetings after that where we focus more on maritime insurance issues, legalities of what occurred, clean up, how well prepared we are to handle these situations, bringing in more of the experts that deal with us and focusing on specific questions. And that's kind of where we're going to attempt to come out sometime in early fall with, hopefully a list of recommendations for state government and maybe some recommendations for the federal government as well.
Absolutely. And I think you're hitting on the key that we were thinking about, and that was that backing up ships at some time in the future, about like a couple of ships within a short period. Can we be doing now? And I know everyone's addressing those issues. So thank you for being here, and we'll look forward to hearing from your committee.
Mr. Chair, before we lose Representative Lehman, I have a serious question and a not-so-serious question.
Okay.
I'll ask the serious question.
Chairman, why do you tell the difference?
and I didn't bring my gun.
So we know.
The serious question is, as part of your investigation, I think one of the biggest concerns that we have here in the building is the liability issue that still remains in terms of the cleanup of the is it the stern or the bow? I don't know. It's in a ship. The part that's still down in Coos Bay. The concern that the Oregon taxpayers aren't left holding the bag on the removal of that thing, and that it be removed in an environmentally sound way that doesn't cost the taxpayers of Oregon. Are you going to deal with that issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Corcoran, that is an interesting issue because that issue may crop to the top faster than the other issues because that's the one we're currently dealing with, and I think that's going to be one that's going to engender a lot of conversation. To date, everything that we've heard on the committee from our report, everything I'm hearing from the local community is that the state of Oregon is not going to bear any cost for removing the aft section of that ship. And, as long as that doesn't change, we're in good shape. I would also add very quickly as an editorial comment that after the initial meeting and everything we're hearing locally, we need to be very clear, or I think people on the committee would be very clear, that overall everybody thinks that this went remarkably well. And we were very fortunate, and things went far, far better than we could have been led to expect. This is not an attempt to go in and say there were all kinds of problems, and we're going to pinpoint them. I think everybody's very comfortable with both the unified command and what people have done down there. But we are very cognizant that there are some financial issues now, and we do not want to be left holding the bag for the aft portion of the ship.
That's true.
The
so, in case you couldn't recognize the serious from the, you are a lawyer, and I thought you were trained to recognize the difference between serious and not so serious questions, but you're probably an expert in delivering those kind of questions. I'm really glad that the governor, by the way, has appointed this task force, and I'm really glad you folks are looking into this. My not so serious question is, as big an advocate as I am of 410 scheduling, can you explain why all of your hearings are at the coast on Fridays?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Corcoran, one of the things that we discovered with the new CARISA is that there was a significant economic impact in the tourism trade. And in that vein, we'd like to continue that, and we like to bring people to the coast as often as we can and make them stay overnight on Thursday night, run the meeting late on Friday. They have to stay over Friday night. So we figure we get two nights lodging and a couple meals out of the deal. That will probably triple the economy in my part of the state.
Thank you so much, Representative.
Ballport, thank you, too. We do hope you arrive there. Thank you very much. Carl, thanks for being here.
Senator George, what I would suggest...
I'm close. Remember the room.
Okay.
Okay.
What I would suggest, as we discussed at the before the gavel was hit the table, would be that the Coast Guard might start by giving some of the initial chronology, and then Mr. Milley and I can fill in some details. That we also have other folks in the audience who can answer particular questions if that comes up.
Sounds great.
Well, I'll start off by saying that I do have a few pages of this written out, and it's on the headquarters desk, and it's available for you. If it gets too drawn out, certainly yell, and I'll start to summarize. But
6 o'clock, you'll see us all going to leave, so you'll...
10 minutes, too, Mike. My dinner with my son tonight is a piece of pizza up in my office before I go to the floor session.
The motor vessel New Caressa was a 639-foot, 36,571 gross ton bulk freight ship of Panamanian registry. It was operated by K&M Company Limited of Tokyo and owned by Green Atlas Shipping SA of Panama. On the night of February 3, 1999, there were 23 crewmen on board. The vessel was inbound from Japan in a ballast condition to pick up 37 tons of wood chips in Coos Bay, Oregon. However, a strong ocean storm with winds that reached 39 knots and seas up to 26 feet was hitting the central Oregon coast on that night. The pilot assigned to join the ship indicated that it shouldn't enter the bay under those conditions and that he would join the ship the next morning. During the early morning hours of Friday of February 4th, the ship went hard aground about 150 yards off a sandy stretch of beach 3 miles north of Coos Bay. And we've convened a one-person formal board inquiry to determine the cause of the grounding. The conclusions of that are not yet published or completed, so those will have to wait until we get done. Coast Guard Marine Safety Office in Portland, Oregon received a report of the grounding from Coast Guard Group North Bend, Oregon at 9 o'clock on February 4th. We activated our crisis action center and began implementing the incident command system launch coordinator station both for a large-scale grounding with a potential major spill scenario. Personnel were immediately dispatched to form a forward command post in the Coos Bay area. Captain Mike Hall, the captain of the Port MSO Portland, and pre-designated center on-scene coordinator activated a response organization headed by the Unified Command. The Unified Command was composed of the federal on-scene coordinator, the state on-scene coordinator, who in this case was Mike Zerlog of CEQ, and the responsible party on-scene coordinator, or RPOSC, in this case, Mr. Bill Miller of Gallagher Marine Systems. The RP contracted Smith America's Inc. as salver, and within hours, various spill and salvage experts were on-scene, or en route. Together, Unified Command rapidly called on a number of federal, state, and local agencies and other stakeholders and contractors to assist in the response. And to date, that's encompassed over 60 different agencies and over 700 people. The response has proven the value of this unified approach to operation. Initially, the Unified Command agreed upon 3 objectives: to ensure personnel safety, to refloat the vessel, and to prevent the discharge of oil. Refloating the vessel was the preferred goal as long as the vessel remained intact. However, the longer it remained grounded, the greater the risk of it leaking the nearly 400,000 gallons of fuel on board. Heavy surf and high winds throughout the next several days made boarding the vessel difficult and dangerous. Nonetheless, the crew of the ship was evacuated for safety reasons, and salvage and response personnel boarded the ship via Coast Guard Air Station North End helicopters to conduct structural assessments. With no salvage vessels in the vicinity of Coos Bay capable of pulling the ship off the sand, the salvage chief, the salvage vessel based in Astoria, Oregon, approximately 170 miles north, was placed on alert and began taking out fuel and provisions with the intent of proceeding directly to sea. However, by the time the salvage chief was ready to depart, the same winter storm that closed the bar at Coos Bay had also closed the bar in Astoria. The departure of the salvage chief was delayed for 2 days. Because the ship could not be refloated promptly, the Unified Command reassessed the risk and revised their objectives accordingly. The objectives became to ensure personnel safety and the safety of the local community, minimize the impact on the environment, and to salvage the vessel.
About what day were we right here where we can, when we conducted the structural assessment and then and determined there was no salvage vessel from the day that it actually became embedded in the, on the shore?
Oh, that was...
We're almost in the first day.
Yes, for the record, state your name, pull the mic out of the phone, although your voice, I think, is going to do fine.
Bill Milley, and on the first day, I was called about 9 o'clock, and I called the owners of the salvage chief immediately and alerted him to the casualty. I also, during the course of the day, called other salvage companies to inform them of the casualty. Salvage chief was in Astoria, but there's no bulk fuel in Astoria, and she did not have sufficient fuel on board. She had to wait until after midnight to get underway. And salvage crew from Smith International, Smith Americas, who had the salvage contract, was aboard on either Friday or Saturday. They arrived Friday afternoon and got on board that afternoon or on Saturday.
That was initially the first day. I mean, it was almost immediate. The environmental risk in this area was substantial. The grounding was close to the South Blue National Estuary and Reserve within Coos Bay. The bay and the reserve contained highly productive marine life, including extensive tidal flats, and provided habitat for migratory shorebirds, seabirds, and marine mammals. Protective booming of sensitive habitats and marinas in the estuary was underway when on day 5, oil began to leak from the ship. And small tar balls began to appear on the ocean beaches. Beach cleanup and oil bird recovery and rehab operations began as well shortly thereafter. Unified Command was faced with many difficult choices. And on February 10th, the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, State On-Scene Coordinator, and the RP On-Scene Coordinator and the salvers determined that trying to pull the damaged ship off during the severe storms forecasted to arrive that night would probably cause hull failure. And if that happened, the ship would likely release most of its oil. Unified Command concluded that waiting to see what would happen to the ship's integrity that night was not an option they were willing to accept, and determined to either try to pull the ship further ashore to facilitate lightering or to ship an in situ onboard burn. This was one of the many decision points during response operation when working collaboratively with stakeholders and other agencies was essential. Unified Command described the options to resource agencies and environmental representatives aiding in the response and explained that one of these two options would be selected in a few hours. Unified Command asked for a consensus recommendation as to which option would better protect our environment, despite the many uncertainties facing them. The wildlife and the habitat experts appreciated the necessity to act rather than do nothing, which would increase the likelihood of a massive spill. They endorsed Unified Command's decision to burn the oil. This decision was also facilitated by the RP surveyor's report made on February 10th. The ship was essentially a constructive total loss at that time. In planning for the in-situ burn, primary concerns for the Unified Command remain safety of the response crew and safety of the local community. Although pre-approval protocols were identified and followed as specified in the Northwest Area Contingency Plan, there are many safety concerns, including air monitoring, detonation, burning accelerants, and evacuations of work crews that had to be resolved before the initially igniting over 400,000 gallons of fuel oil, approximately 350,000 gallons of which was Bunker C. Naval architects and marine engineers worked with the Navy Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team from Whidbey Island, Washington, to identify where to place explosives to rupture the fuel tank tops and to place locally brewed napalm mixture to ignite and help sustain the fuel burn. The fire burned for about 33 hours and successfully consumed about half of the ship's fuel load. although the risk of a major spill has been cut in half, there is still an estimated 130 to 155,000 gallons of fuel on board. Furthermore, due to the pounding surf, the ship is split into two pieces, a bow section and a stern section. These sections began drifting apart from each other in the heavy waves and wind.
I'm going to rest one section that continues to come up. And, of course, everyone's memory begins to fail, and a lot of folks weren't on the coast during these intensive series of storms that were there about those first 5 days. But one question that keeps being asked over and over again is, gee, we ended up trying to pump that remaining 130,000, 155,000 gallons. Why didn't you get those pumps up here, pump to the plastic tank sitting on the helicopter deck and have some of the bigger logging type helicopters, you know what I'm talking about, that class helicopter, move those on shore and actually set them on top of a waiting truck. Explain why that wouldn't have worked.
Well, it's totally impractical. I cannot imagine flying a large container of liquid like that safely with a helicopter, large enough to do any real good. We did, in fact, on the first couple of days, initiate a group starting to make plans for pumping, but we weren't thinking about doing that.
You were going to run the lines on shore at that
point. We were going to run lines on shore, and that was a terribly difficult, technically difficult operation to run the hose, and we had to run the hose in the air, not through the surf.
Right.
And we had a ship of some 900 feet offshore at that time. And it was moving. It was moved throughout the operation. And then we didn't have any place to put the oil. You're talking 400,000 gallons of oil, and that's a lot of oil. As you saw later in the operation, we did put some tanks ashore, and it was a major operation to stage those tanks in there. We had the first discharge of oil from that ship on the fourth day. And that was the first indication of hull failure. And about the same time, we had flooding of the engine room, which meant we lost not all power, but we had to throw out the emergency generator on the ship for a few days. But she was coming apart then.
I had a gentleman, I asked him about the day the decision was made to burn the ship. Of course, there was quite a lot of activity in the Capitol, discussing that. And I had one person who had been Navy demolition that said to me, as soon as you set that ship on fire, it'll be two pieces. And the other day, someone said to me, that ship was going to be two pieces anyway because the ship is designed to be suspended in the water if you wedge one end of that ship into the tank and the other part is moving with really hard pounding surf. It just structurally can't sustain it. Is that a fair description of the dilemma you face?
That's exactly right. The burning had absolutely nothing to do with the breaking. It just happened to occur about the same time. What happens when the ship is parallel to the beach like that, too, is that the currents accelerate around the bow and stern of the ship from the surf and they scour. So the ship winds up sitting supported virtually like that. Yeah. And it's not a new phenomenon. It's happened time and time again throughout the world.
And as you pointed out, that's not a stress that ships are designed to absorb. It basically tries to fold it in half. The grounded vessel was now broken in two and continued to release oil. The greatest risk came from the bow section, which carried the majority of the remaining oil. On February 17th, Unified Command decided that the most efficient option would be to minimize and mitigate further discharge of oil, was to tow the bow section to sea and to sink it. The RP requested that Summit America Inc. contract to salve or refloat, tow, and dispose of the bow section where its impact could be minimized. In this case, we selected 248 miles offshore in a depth of about 1,600 fathoms, or about 9,600 feet. The water temperature there is about 34 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that temperature, the oil would congeal into a solid mass and be trapped inside the structure and be virtually harmless to the environment. This plan was approved by the Federal On Sea Coordinator and received the concurrence of the Regional Response Team. This ODRP contracted the ocean-going tugboat Sea Victory, owned by Crowley Marine Services in Seattle, Washington. Mid-America's ordered an especially long synthetic floating tow line to be flown in from Holland with an ETA of about February 21. Unified Command also decided to remove as much unburned oil as possible while waiting for tow preparations to be completed. And at that time, lightering, pumping the oil from the vessels would be difficult due to the high viscosity of the oil, variously described as peanut butter and molasses or soft asphalt.
Can I just wonder, back you up just a little bit, talking about the synthetic floating tow line, one of the rumors that is floating around this place is the fact that that was actually produced in the United States and flown to Holland and then brought back. Can you clarify that? Because one of the things we're trying to do is clarify the record.
And there, the line that we use in this is a high modulus polyethylene ethylene fiber. And it is produced by Samson up in Washington. They're one of the producers of it. There are other producers of a similar line. The first thing we started on this thing was a search for suitable lengths and suitable sizes of this line and any other line that might be of suitable material in use. We found essentially two sources. One was the line we got from Holland. The one we got from, the other one was down in Australia. And for some reason, it would have taken a lot longer to get the one from Australia. I don't know if it was out in the outback or what, but the one from Holland was the most readily available, and that was the one that we got.
The lightering crews endured difficult and dangerous conditions, heavy storm and heavy sea, and they pumped about 110,000 gallons of liquid off the ship. Unfortunately, nearly all of it was found to be seawater. In fact, all but about 150 gallons of sea. The lightering was secured on February 22nd, with most of the 135,000 gallons still on board, as the bow section was nearly ready to begin its effort to get it off the beach. We began trying to hook up the tow line on February 23rd, and the same storms that hindered us all along made that difficult. We finally made the connection on February 26th. It took about 3 days, and I'm beginning to summarize now. Yeah. And we're running a little long. About 3 days later, we finally cleared the beach on the evening of March 1st. And it was towed to sea. Following the tow was the Oregon Responder, anticipating that we may have a marginal release at the sink of the Oregon Responder, which is a skimming vessel, was to accompany the bow section to the settling site and take care of any oil that may rise. Again, storms hindered that. The Oregon Responder was allowed to seek shelter and went up to Astoria. And after about, about 5:18 p.m., the tow wire on the Sea Victory, that would be on, still on the first,
right? Yeah.
The first one?
I think it was the first.
The tow wire on the Sea Victory broke at the turn of the Sea Victory, and the nucleus of the south section then became adrift. Moving to the northeast at about 7 knots, which is an indication of how severe the storm was.
The problem with the chafing was probably the fact, and that's one thing it never, I think, quite explained in it. In fact, if you had two vessels in heavy, heavy seas, with probably a rope going, you know, taut and then not. And
the last few hours before it parted, the Sea Victory was making about 2 knots astern.
Under power.
Under power, under full power.
Right.
And at one point, you know, that is a very high ship, a very deep ship. She had a tremendous amount of sail area there. And just before she parted, she yawed and went broad to the wind. And it was evidently that turning and the additional forces that went with it that was enough to break this whole line. And it was not the expensive line we flew in from Holland that broke. It was a wire rope on the tug.
And it was essentially a hurricane, except that it was subtropical, and the winds were gusting up to 100 knots, which we're pushing here. The dock section came to rest the next morning at 0700 in Walport, Oregon.
I'll remember the comment of the homeowner say he looked out and he thought, oh, it must be the ghost of the new Carissa.
If only it were just a ghost. Environmental impacts here were nearly identical to the potential impacts in Coosa Bay. Same concerns, same issues. Notably, we were tracking the drifting vessel and forecasted where the area vicinity where it made rounds and had the response personnel already in place. And either at the same time or very near the same time, had placed protective strategies in the bay. Again, though, with the storms that we were enduring, protective boom is only so effective. Recovery efforts continued, and on March 8th, the Sea Victory finally pulled us out off the beach in Walport. This time in company with the Tug and the Toma, the Oregon Responder and the Oregon Responder's escort and assist vessel. The four made their way out to 280 miles offshore on March 11th. And on that day, units from the U.S. Navy sunk the bow section. In 1,811 fathoms, which is 10,866 feet of water, about 282 nautical miles offshore. Again, with the water temperatures there, we don't have to worry about that oil. There was a release of oil as we had anticipated at the sinking, but by the time we got there, there was none to be found or recovered by the Oregon Responder. The Oregon Responder had to back off, as did all the vessels, when the Bremerton fired the torpedo. Otherwise, they would have been likely targets rather than witnesses. Which left us with the stern section, which remains around at Coosa Bay. The stern section included one bunker fuel tank and a diesel fuel tank in the double bottom. And about 18 other additional tanks, either bay tanks or submerged tanks that were under the water in the engine room. All these have been opened and the oil cleared from the tanks. The oil has been removed from the engine room by skimming or pumping directly from some of the tanks and then flown ashore. About 14,000 gallons of oil mixture and over 1,000 cubic yards of debris have been removed from the stern section to date. And that brings us pretty much where we are. I've got some more stuff here, but basically just talked about the in-flight command and the things we did. So that's I'll share it with you if you would like. Or you can do other questions.
Representing the owners. When I look at the evidence, I just sit there and I think as representing place blame, it was just a circumstances of a bunch of unbelievable conditions that all converged at one time.
I've been dealing with marine casualties for 33 years now. I've seen a lot of them. I have never seen one that presented so many difficult decisions as this one. And I've never seen one where all the choices we had to make were from a list of bad choices. things happen very quickly. I hate to say anything bad about our coast, but our coast is one of the most inhospitable coasts in the world for accidents like this, and it always has been. Ships that go aground in the Northwest are generally lost. What we could have done differently in this? I think the answer to that is not much. All through this operation, the Unified Command worked extremely well together. and we kept in mind the goals that we had from the outset, and we kept pointing in that direction. We made the decisions that we had to make, and we made them quickly. The other thing we did that was right was that we had contingency plans. Every time we picked a direction to go, we were saying, what's going to possibly go wrong out here? Let's figure out what we can do about that.
You probably begin to learn that by about the third day. If it can go wrong, it will, right?
I learned that a long time ago.
At the Murphy chart.
Yeah,
I learned that a long time ago.
I think one of the critical issues in this, and the thing might have made a difference, and I say might, because it's a big might, is that if the salvage chief had been ready to sail, and had been able to sail and get there sooner, there may have been a possibility that the chief could have been refloated. And I can't blame the salvage chief for not being ready. That's a commercial matter. But if that had happened, we would have had a better shot at it. Other than that, I think things went just about as well as they could have been expected under the circumstances.
Let me back that up a little bit. You know, the very fact that, two ships. Is there anything we should look at as far as positioning a more secure area? Are the conditions
that you have enough steam or that you started before you got a grant?
Those are the kind of questions that as we look forward, how do we prevent this from happening again?
That's a strange thing that happens, is that the same type of accident seems to happen in groups.
Pirates will flatten freeze, right?
And not only freeze, sometimes half a dozen, but they'll happen over a bend and then they'll go away and they won't happen again for a while. But ships drag anchor frequently. As a matter of fact, anchor drag is the design failure mode of anchoring systems. Because if a ship drags this anchor, it can pick it up again, recover it, use it again, and deploy it, and perhaps deploy it under conditions where it's not going to drag quite as quickly. If it's designed to break, it's lost it. It's lost the possibility of it. As far as the details of what we should do about anchoring, I'm not qualified to answer that.
Concept is rather than break the chain and all the mechanism leading you, no means whatsoever anchoring. The idea is that under a certain amount of stress, like these nasty winds and waves, that's a possibility.
It's going to drive.
And then the only answer is you put your position to ship somewhere else. And I would imagine then it would depend on the depth of the water off the shore, where the ship is being anchored.
It depends on the depth, and it depends on the condition of the holding ground, the bottom, the type of holding ground, depends on the type of anchor to a certain degree. Got a lot of variables in it, and most of all, it depends on the weather. And it depends on the judgment of the master as to when he thinks he should pick up and go.
Not to bring that ship in. And I know that no one wants to place blame in there in any way. Should we suggest that under certain conditions you might take that left loop with the other? I know we're playing a game of what if here.
Yeah, I don't really feel comfortable answering that, but I think
that's pretty good.
It's a matter of professional judgment.
Absolutely.
And then the evaluation of the risk that the man makes based on his experience. and you don't want to take too much choice away from him.
Mm-hmm. Chair, could I ask you a question? I guess along those lines, it never occurred to me that they should have brought the ship in, not under those conditions across the bottom like that. But I was curious for why somebody didn't take it back out.
Sir?
I was curious as to why somebody didn't try to take the ship out further to sea. I mean,
I don't have any idea.
In my experience, which is certainly not running ships, but listening to the folks who deal with them, and it's much easier to ride a storm out further out to sea than it is in closer to shore. So it never occurred to me to bring it in, which could be very, very dangerous, but rather to take it back out, and I was surprised that didn't happen.
Felt secure in the anchor is probably what was.
Probably the answer.
Mr. Chair?
Sir.
Yeah, just a little technical thing here on this Coast Guard testimony here. And about the fifth line, Dan said the ship conditioned the K&M to pick up 37 tons. That's not even hardly a truckload of wooden ships. Was that 3,700 tons or 37,000 tons? Or?
To be honest, I would guess 37,000, but I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I'm sure it's obviously
ship was, her normal trade was cruise day to Japan. And I'm sure she was going to load full, or very nearly full. She had a capacity of, her generate capacity was something like 44,000 tons, so it had to be 37,000.
Thank you,
sir. Wayne, could we get you, I was just told that for the record, we didn't get your complete name, and we'll need to have that for the record, so if you could go ahead and state your complete name for us.
Certainly. Lieutenant Commander Dwayne, I'll spell that for you. D-A-W-A-Y-N-E. Last name Penberthy, Penberthy.
Who do we have left? Can I go to the end of the bank?
You know, the issue was we were very fortunate. I when I look at those. The estuaries, when I look at the fish life, they could have been dangerous. I think we were very, very fortunate to suffer more loss. And I think part of that was, too, the fact that so many resources were thrown to making sure that didn't occur. Is there anything you see that we could have done differently there? I mean, obviously, if I were sitting there looking at what the end result was, I would say what we did was successful. And
Mr. Chair, yes, I would say that given the circumstances, and particularly given the circumstance that the salvage chief was unable to get out of the across the bar in time to be able to attempt to salvage the ship before it started breaking up, I think that everything else worked about as well as could be expected, not without glitches, not without occasional miscommunications and small things, but generally, Mr. Milley said, there were some very tough decisions that had to be made, and I think the process for making them through the unified command structure was a good process. I think it was a very open process. I think we learned a lot from it, and I think generally it proved the wisdom of establishing that process in the wake of the Exxon Valdez disaster, and I think we would certainly not want to see any major changes in that process. I think in terms of readiness, prevention, which is always the best approach, there might have been more done, particularly in the, one of the things I think we would ought to at least look into in the future is the appropriateness of providing more support for operations like the salvage chief that would enable them to be at a higher state of readiness.
That's what
exactly. What exactly that would be, whether it's something that can be done by an individual state or as a matter of national effort, I'm not prepared to say, but I think it's something worth looking into.
That is exactly what I had in mind, because we pay right now, we pay our firefighting bombers, you know, the big twin and four-engine aircraft, we pay them a kind of a standby fee to be ready to go at any time, and that was one thing I thought about when I looked at that and saw, okay, we didn't know, we weren't prepared at all. I couldn't blame anyone, because how would I know something like this would happen? Yeah, and it may be something we could look at as far as making sure that at any given time they were ready to move. One of the other issues, I don't think it would have done a lot of good relative to this incident being offshore 900 feet and all the surf that we were finding. But I was concerned a couple of years ago when we were dealing with a port situation in which the containment booms were not available. And I thought, boy, it seems like we would have this stuff readily available, at least someone having this stuff in a van or a trailer that could be immediately moved to. Where are we in relationship to that kind of equipment? Are we prepared now?
It was not a problem with boom in his equipment. We had several response contractors bring the equipment in. We had the boom that was available in Cruz Bay that was positioned ready to use long before we had oil in the water. We were quite lucky in this that we had 4 days to prepare. We had enough preparation made that we moved some equipment in, sent the people home, and then called them back, and we had the actually had oil in the water.
I would add to that this part of the country, you're really pretty well off as far as response equipment. There are other parts of the country that depend on long-distance cascading of large numbers of boom and things to be able to respond to some of their worst-case scenarios. But this part of the country, there's an ample supply. We could have darkened the water with boom had that been necessary.
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
I've never been able to get somebody to explain to me, and I can ask you this question, and you won't be stuck with any kind of legal reasons why you can't answer anything, but tell me some way or another so that I can justify all of this hype about fouling up, and I quote pristine beach. I'm getting to where I don't like to see the word or hear the word pristine any much more than I like to hear a few other words that I can think about. And when I was raised at a time when I was old enough to understand the shipping damage that was had during the World War II era, when hundreds of ships were torpedoed and run down with oil in them that would have made the Exxon Valdez look like a teapot instead of what it was. They were shot down or gunned down, bombed down, any way you want, loaded. The tankers were the ones they were after as much as anything because they can torpedo a tanker and stop it from getting someplace. They shut down the rest of the army. They did it in the South Seas. They did it on the, quote, pristine beaches that we see on our tour guides and everything else. And I, reading history and seeing the movies of history, not one single time have I ever seen anybody mention anything about oil ducks, dead seals. Matter of fact, I think if anybody would have even said anything like that, they would have probably taken them into a concentration camp and put them there for the rest of the war and charged them with treason. Why, all of a sudden, is oil such a great big problem when it wasn't basically even mentioned or done anything about? I mean, the only reason they didn't want an oil slick going during World War II was that somebody could see it from the air and track the ship down miles away by the sight of it in the moonlight or something. Why is oil all of a sudden now the big deal?
Well, it's certainly not good for birds and bunnies. So.
I didn't say it was, but I mean, why is now it the quote tragic to these pristine beaches when obviously we still have all these pristine beaches after all the oil that was dumped in the oceans during World War II?
Well, I'll certainly concede that pristine is an overused word. In fact, on the copy that I read from, I struck out pristine. I would contend that there are very, very few pristine areas left on this planet. However, I think that oil releases or releases of any material is not, lack of better terms, digestible, is quite a different thing to do that by accident or intentionally than it is to do it as an act of war. And certainly we should do whatever we can to minimize that. And I think that's where our regulations are focused.
Mr. Chair, I'm in complete agreement with that. I wouldn't for the world want to see us just intentionally go out and do something. And I think it's really tragic when it happens. But I can't understand how we've got a seal in the ocean or any other kind of a bird anywhere in our sea system when it wasn't even so much as a mentioned problem. I mean, you don't even have an afterthought when you read these articles about all the damage. Look at Pearl Harbor, where they've got a boat over there that's still bubbling up oil after all these years. I mean, these things don't make sense to a common, hard-headed businessman.
I won't try to understand or be able to explain the societal changes that have taken place over the last 20, 30 years. Maybe you can do that a little bit better than me.
But the seals and Mr. Chair, the seals, the fish, the sea lions, the birds don't know societal changes.
This is true. We do, though.
I understand that, but I mean, there's no pictures of it. It doesn't show it. Nobody even bothers to mention about it, saying what a tragedy it was. You know, just as a byline in this, and I just don't understand that, because for me, oil is oil, and it doesn't change a whole lot over a period of time. There may get a few little tricks in the refining process and stuff like that, but basically, it's a product that doesn't mix well with water, and it doesn't mix well with the life within those deals. I can personally say I wouldn't particularly care to jump in and be bathed in it. And you have read articles, though, about people that got blown out of ships and ships that sank, and they had to come up through burning oil or burning gas on the water and that kind of thing, but never a mention about any damage to this life. These beaches have come through. They're tourist beaches now. There's no sign of the bad effects. Look how many they call, what was it, Iron Bottom Sound or something over there in the where all those ships were settled, and they're still there. Those beaches are pretty. There's shells, there's coral, there's stuff there now. I just have a hard time.
May I?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Senator Fisher, I think that clearly the same consciousness about ecological effects of oil spills was not around in the, at least among the general scientific, technical, or professional community in the years of the war. And as you say, nobody would have been probably thought sane to question what happened during acts of war. I think what has happened in the past 30 years is a tremendous growth in consciousness of what the effects of oil are on birds, mammals, and ecosystems, and there has been a great deal of legislative effort at both the national and state level to focus on preventing it from happening, because it doesn't make sense when it does happen, and then cleaning up the oil spill. The law of 1990 is a very comprehensive law that really gave rise to the unified command structure that allowed us to minimize the damages from this spill as much as we did. I think even in current wars like the Gulf War, 1991, I think it was tremendous releases of oil, and there was quite a bit of consciousness about the impact that that had on the wildlife in the Gulf, which you wouldn't have seen in the Second World War, the Korean War. I agree.
I could address that too. Mr. Marsh says that a friend of mine, when he was over there during the Gulf War, commented to me that it was startling to him to look at oceans where you didn't see any fish life, to look at any kind of wildlife, and there weren't any. And so, I think it's proper that we have a consciousness that the things we're doing have a big impact. A lot of discussion that's occurred in this committee is relative to what are we doing to the rivers and what's the effect of that when it gets out and circulates back into the estuaries. So, I think the environmental consciousness of America is a really good thing. At the same time, I do wonder where the balance point is. I think about books that were written
as the early explorers rounded the Horn and came up along the Gulf of Mexico and up along the California coast, and they saw the oceans on fire. And the reason was, off the coast of California, Southern California, there was ruptures out there from the fact that there was a lot down there, and the fact that oil just poured out into the sea and a lightning would strike and set the ocean on fire. And those were pretty amazing things. I mean, who could even imagine the quantities of oil that could have been spilling in there for who knows how long? And that's, you know, one issue that we need to deal with. But getting back to this again, I don't think there's a single person that doesn't want to be better prepared. I mean, you know, the very fact that we were ready with the containment booms, and we kept these quantities to a minimum. And, okay, tell us, what do you, when you look at the damage that wildlife,
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kay Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We were really lucky in the fact that, for the most part, oil did not enter the estuaries, which are extremely valuable to Oregon in terms of the abundance of fish and wildlife and rearing and feeding habitats that they provide. But I'd like to address Senator Fisher's question for a moment, and that is that these fish and wildlife provide economic returns to the state of Oregon, and it's a very important component to the coastal communities. And I think that's why Oregon is looking at how we can better protect our fish and wildlife. And let me give you an example. In this particular instance, we had 450 oiled wildlife that are in the morgue right now. That means they died. Those are the ones that we can account for. There's probably a lot more that we can't. And that represents about 50 species of birds. Of those, 12 are marbled murrelets, which are a threatened species, and I think that most members of this committee are familiar with the effect on Oregon's economy when we have threatened or endangered species, and we need to take account of those and make sure that we protect them. We have we were able to rehabilitate 200 birds and release about 150, which means that not all of them survived, but a good share of them did. There was a bald eagle that was oiled, and we could confirm that it had been oiled. But we also saw others that were feeding on oiled wildlife, and so the long-term effects of what that might have on some of these threatened species is a concern. We have 5 harlequin ducks that were confirmed oiled. They're also a sensitive species. And, of course, we have the total population of breeding snowy plovers is 100 in the state. That's an endangered species. They breed on the coast. Of those, 44 have been oiled repeatedly. They were oiled, we cleaned them, we put them back out, they were oiled again. We know of at least one that died. We know of 2 more that are missing. And those are all real important to the state of Oregon because they represent animals that are very few in number, and when we can't protect them or we can't make sure that they're going to survive, then they have real impacts on other aspects of Oregon's economy, our forest industry, our fishing industry, and I think that's why. I think maybe the reason that people didn't pay as much attention to the oiling of beaches during the war was because there were fewer people and a lot more wildlife. And so I think that's probably the reason.
Chair, I don't want to give the wrong impression. We're very, very protective of Oregon, and I want to conserve our wildlife. It's not my intention. I'm just saying, you know, we look at one little spot spill now, and we go ballistic. And we literally had spills the length and breadth of the ocean and on beaches from everywhere from Siberia to the South Pacific and all over the place, the tonnage and the oil that went down the rivers in Europe and all that kind of thing, by the standards of what we're talking about, there shouldn't be any kind of wildlife left in any nature. Those ought to be left barren, completely sterile channels now with all of the oil and stuff that they got. Again, you know, there's a certain amount of recovery that takes place and so forth, and that's why I'm saying if we had the kind of carnage that we had during something as violent as World War II, regardless of how many more there was. And I'm not so sure, for instance, I'd be willing to bet we have more seals and sea lions right now than we had during World War II. And so that doesn't necessarily hold true. And somehow or another, most of those things survived. I've never again basically ever heard anybody write of a species that went extinct during World War II because of the fact that they were all ill to death or anything like that. So, and we had species that were in danger back then, just the same as we do now. That this species has been in danger over all of history, as near as I can tell. So I just am not satisfied in my mind the to-do that we make over war, not that we want to allow it to happen if we can help it, but it just seems to me that some of our efforts may be a little misplaced.
One of the issues that intrigued me was the idea that we were dealing with a relatively new ship, and that was very fortunate, but it still didn't mean it stayed together. And I suppose, Duane, you'd be the one. Of ships that are entering in. I know one of the complaints has always been, you know, that a lot of gardens get dumped before the garbage dumping so that you don't dump it at sea. And so there's little things like that we look at. But, you know, we are going to be looking at greater numbers of ships in the future. And so tell us about what the inspection program is.
The inspection program, by and large, and I'll start off by saying that I am not a naval architect and have very limited experience in that field. The inspection program that each ship undergoes is primarily a function of the requirements of its flag state. In this case, it's Panama. They have inspection requirements. They have inspectors that visit the ships on a routine basis and inspect those flag vessels similar to the way we inspect U.S. flag vessels.
I'm insurance carrier, too, insurance carrier.
I couldn't speak for the carriers, but I would imagine that if I was underwriting someone, I would want them to meet some standards.
In the last few years, there's been a move by not only classification society set the standards for ship structure and the like, and a ship that's not classified isn't going to be insured. And the classification society has surveyors that inspect your ships. Some of them are very good, some of them are lousy. And some of the classifications, most of the classification societies are very good. A few of them are less than good. And recently, the insurers that carry the liability insurance, they're called T&I clubs, they've begun an inspection program.
That's primarily because of the cost of the environmental cleanup. It's hard to know.
I'm sorry?
Primarily because of the cost of the environmental cleanup.
That's a great deal of it, and all of have also been a lot of other claims that they've been exposed to that have made them realize that they'd better have a say in that too. And I'm going to talk about the sort of state control program there.
In addition to the flag state inspections that in this case Panama and their class society would have, and who was class in this NK. That they wouldn't conduct. We also in the U.S. have a port state program, which is a program that has been adopted by other international maritime organization member countries as well. We have a matrix based pretty much on statistical data as far as vessel performance and compliance with international maritime organization standards. Some vessels are rated higher or lower on the performance scale, and they're visited more or less frequently as a result of that. by our personnel when they first visit port. This particular vessel was not scheduled to be boarded, to my knowledge. When it came in, its performance had been satisfactory.
From all the pictures we saw earlier before things happened to the ship, it did look like it was well maintained. The ship looked to be in
very good condition.
And our inspectors, when they did the first initial assessments, said the same thing. The condition was very good. Yeah, the material condition of the vessel was not an issue at that point.
When did you know the ship happened to enter the Columbia story? There is a schedule that first started dealing with. Who knows what's coming? I mean, I imagine you punch up a computer with the ID number of that ship, and again, that you were talking about, is that how this whole process works? So we know what kind of ship is entering the water?
Vessel agents will notify us. There's a requirement for 24-hour notice of arrival to vessels. It's essentially a request to enter port. It's common that the request is granted unless otherwise responded to. The agent gives us the name of the vessel, the official number, the flag state, the numbers of the crew, those sorts of things, and we plug it into our port state control matrix, and we come up with an answer that says it's a priority 1 through 4, and based on that, we determine whether it's boarded under the program. It can be boarded at sea prior to its entry, or it could be boarded not at all, or anywhere along those that continuum, if you will.
But you see a lot of ships that do have, as a
new ship, they have landing decks on them, or you wouldn't want to land on that thing when it's pushed in high seas.
But the point is a lot of these ships are equipped that way, so boarding is made easy. If not, the
Coast Guard just lowers them on by arm.
Well, that's not the normal process for a pilot going on board, or for our personnel going on board, for that matter. Normally, we would either go out on a pilot boat, as the pilots normally do, or else we would go out on one of our own boats. Or if it's a boarding done for the vessel, either for entry or for, say, beginning an inspection that's scheduled, we would have the agent arrange for transport. He may come up with another commercial vessel to get out there. On the stern section presently? Oh, there's no real way to tell that. I mean, I can't give you a quantity.
Somebody estimating it? I mean,
I can tell you that over the last 3 days, we've taken suction on several different tanks that had produced oil in the past and got a total of 40 gallons. So it's less and less every day.
Soon before it's cut up, that someone will have to determine that. Cutting into this section is not a problem. There's nothing there to worry about, or it's cleaned enough that we can remove it. Some of those kinds of decisions.
The oil that's left is probably little pockets in inaccessible places that we're not going to be able to get, and it's oil and pipes that we can't get, and things like that. When we cut it up, we're very likely to have some releases of oil. And one of the requirements of the contract is that there be a pollution prevention plan in place and a pollution response plan in place so it can be cleaned up as soon as it's released. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that you can't do anything about.
I mean, my question is, what happens to the metal, the remains after it's cut up and hauled away? But do you have any say in that, or is that the contractor who goes?
Oh, you better believe I'm not saying it.
Where does this go?
It's probably going to be scrapped and recycled. That's the present plan for it.
That there wasn't much of a market for scrap metal. I understood there wasn't much of a market for scrap metal,
The scrap metal market is very volatile, and we may have to pay to have it hauled away. If that's the case, so be it.
This was a double-hull tank, or double-tank, double-shell hull somewhere in there, you know, what you're talking about. Can we draw any conclusions? I mean, we've been told for the last few years that double hull tankers are safer. This thing seemed to hold together quite well for a long time.
It's not a tank ship, so it didn't fall under that requirement for a double hull, cargo hull. The fuel that was in this vessel, much like even a double hull tank ship, is the fuel that's not cargo is carried in the space between the tank top and the hull of the vessel. There's no double hull protection there. But ship construction standards since the big film of the last couple of years, the Titanic, has changed so much that, I mean, the difficulty we had thinking this thing is just kind of indicates the level of change during that time. So they're a lot more stable, a lot more structurally sound, and a lot more just safer.
Mm. If you ask me that question in about a year, I might be able to give you a real good answer. I've just been invited to be on a committee that's looking at double hull ships, and particularly their what happens to them in casualty situations.
Actually, it's impossible to build a structure that big and that long and of that weight and make it sturdy enough that it could balance on the middle without bending or breaking. It's not designed for that. It depends on having support over a large area. To be something in my mind, and this is a very simplification, but you can maybe put 100 pounds per square inch and not do much to your hand this way, but you sure aren't going to do it at this point. And you've got a situation there where you've got so much weight and so much length that to have any kind of a structure no wider than that and no deeper than that to be able to be rigid enough to stand up when it all of a sudden is not getting support over its entire length is about a totally impossible situation. So there's about no way that you could ever build any kind of a profitable ship that would be strong enough to withstand something like that without coming apart just of its own weight, basically.
That's right. If you built it like that stiff and that heavy, it wouldn't float. No, you couldn't carry any cargo in it. So it wouldn't be much use to you.
So you're subject to having to maintain some type of watch and some type of care not to get into that situation, or no matter what you're going to do with a boat. I know I had some friends that were lost in a fishing boat in Alaska, and they got a little into some good fishing, and they didn't want to quit and didn't realize they were in some pretty shallow water, and they way overloaded their boat because of their desire to get a little more money out of it, and wound up and had the boat just beaten to pieces when it came to rest and wasn't supported by enough water around, and cost one of them their life.
In a large percentage of the casualties I've dealt with, it's been commercial concerns that have driven people to stay a little too long, do a little too much, and lose their ship.
We've nearly long since come to the point where we can engineer more safety into the vessels. It's almost entirely, I'd say probably 80 or more percent now human factors and commercial concerns, training, all those issues play into that. That weigh in now. So you're absolutely right. It's usually the choices that are made by the people that get us into trouble.
He's asking about, okay, now we know where we've been and where we can go in the future, what do we do? This was so unusual. You wonder if you could anticipate everything. The very fact that we would have hurricane force winds and massive seas. I mean, the very fact we were worried about losing the skimming ship, you know, to actually having it sunk by the seas. Very unusual condition. I'm sure all of you have exchanged ideas. What do you see in this? Do you see us just having more equipment available? If this was to happen again tomorrow, what would we do different?
Oh, gosh.
if you had a wish list of things that, okay, we'd like to have this there. I mean, it sounded like we were well prepared with equipment that was in Coos Bay.
We were well prepared for the oil throughout. We weren't as well prepared for the ship casualty itself and for dealing with the ship. That's right. We have in the Columbia River probably the best system in the world for responding to oil spills with the Marine Fire and Safety Association. And what the really good thing about it is, I think, is that it responds immediately. Because there's always confusion in the first 24 hours. There's always a lot of bad information going around. It takes people time to get to the site and find out what's going on and get things going. So that's a wonderful system.
Yeah. They'll look for instructions to somebody after they've actually begun to respond.
That's right. And I would like to, I think that system could be expanded. I think that system could be expanded to include salvage and to include things like salvage chief. There are some countries that, I'm thinking particularly South Africa, which has two tugs, or has until recently had two tugs that were government subsidized, and one had to be in South African waters at all times. England has, as a result of the Breyer casualty a few years ago, has tugs under contract and ready to go in the North Sea. France, as a result of the Amoco Cadiz casualty, has had tugs available to them since then, and they were likely to go out and put Marines on the ship and make them take that tow. Italy and Spain have tugs of opportunity system, much like has recently been set up in Puget Sound. There are ways to do that, but it's not commercially viable these days to have a ship sitting on salvage station ready to respond. It's got to have some input from government.
And you know, obviously there's other people out there.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be something either to be negotiated or through regulation. It might, as I suggested earlier, be something because of the interstate nature of it that might need to be coordinated among all of the coastal states. I belong, for example, to the oil spill task force that covers Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California. And we get together and talk about issues exactly like this. I expect this will be an issue we'll talk about and what the exact mechanism might be, whether through agreement or regulation or something else would be something to be discussed. But yes, we and our organizations, our sister states and province would be the right group.
California, somebody coming up out of California, it is have, you know, strategic. The story is a lobby thing here and a few sound. Someone could respond to a situation. That was the heartbreaker. You kept thinking, some way to get that thing floated and get it done now. Set of circumstances of just didn't.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know you have time constraints here. I had just wanted to submit for the record three fact sheets that we prepared for this presentation.
One is on the steering section, which I think has been pretty well covered in the testimony to date. And I just wanted to reaffirm what Representative Lehman said, that, you know, we're very satisfied with the commitment of the owners and insurers to take care of the current section. We will be entering into some agreement with them to tie up certain details of that, but basically we're very satisfied that this will not be a cost on the state of Oregon. The other fact sheets, one deals with the impact of this on our spill program. We have basically 5.5 people for the entire state dealing with spills. We probably, in the first month of this particular spill, had assigned 50 FTE to various responses. I think one of the things we would like to see is at least a somewhat more robust spill program in the state of Oregon. So this spells out some of the activities that might be beneficial. Among them, better use of volunteers. We had a little bit of confusion and a lot of disappointed people who would have liked to have done more. We had a few years ago a funded volunteer program that we had to disband for want of funds. Something like that might be useful to think about in the future. We might have benefited as a state, although the Coast Guard and the Responsible Party have enormous expertise. As a member of the Unified Command, we might have benefited from some expertise of our own on some maritime issues, just so we could participate more fully in that. And then outreach and public education and so on, I think, are other things. Then the third fact sheet deals with the natural resource damage assessment, which is the process which is now going on to assure that whatever damages to natural resources that are remain as a result of this are addressed in the future. That's a federal requirement. It's a very sensible requirement, and I think we just give you some facts about that. And then I would just underscore what Kay said about the need to address the issues of the private commercial interests, the oyster growers, crab, Dungeness crab, and fishery folks, to make sure that they are not only adequately compensated for whatever damages, but also that their concerns about the impact of this on the market conditions that they have to work under is ameliorated to the extent possible.
Very critical issue. We always remember the Alar scare when all of a sudden the market for apples went to zero, but over the whole year the market for apples was just about normal, but the devastating effect on the growers. Hey, Senator Fisher.
I have a question here on your DEQ spill program changes. You got down there the first 4 weeks following the grounding. Just some interesting situations there. How does 7 drug labs figure into this, or one near miss? Was that somebody threw a tar ball at somebody and almost hit them, or what's the...
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I actually don't know what the near miss is. The reason these are all listed here is these are the responsibilities of the spill program folks, the 5.5 FTE that we have, and this just indicates that there were a large number of activities that went on while the new Carissa response action was going on, and that we had to figure out how to respond to them as well as to the new Carissa. Drug labs we get involved in because of the potential for spill of chemicals.
Now, Mr. Chair, I see I was taking this as being something that happened during in that process of the new Carissa. I didn't realize you're talking about what happened overall.
The same
the entire thing.
Yeah. First 4 weeks, yeah.
Okay.
The near miss, I am told, Mr. Senator Fisher, was a barge carrying a full load of vacuum oil lost its tow line near Cousset, and it was the line was recovered the next day, but
A near miss is something that could be a significant spill, but in this case it didn't turn out that way, fortunately.
Hey, you have a last word, so make it good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reference the written testimony that I had passed out, which includes information that I quoted in terms of the numbers of fish and wildlife that have been impacted. And we also included some information in there about needs of the Fish and Wildlife Agency and how we might be better prepared if and when in the future we have to face a similar situation.
I can see you folks coordinating with the volunteer aspect of this to make sure that I think a lot of people respond. I mean, we're seeing that with the stream issue, you know, restoring the stream. There's people ready to volunteer. You know, we've gone from ecotourism to ecoterrorism to ecotourism. That's a really good thing. And so there's a lot of people who would like to do something constructive. And I know people on the coast. I think you had a list of people who wanted to be able to do something.
Mr. Chair, I believe we had about 1,200 or so people. I think it was over 1,000 people who had some form of training and were part of a network that could have been called out to help in a situation like this. Now, there are lots of issues about just what they could have done and given the adequate training and protection and so on. But
if you think about it, if we would have in fact had a major loss of oil, if it would have been 100,000 gallons that just instantly hit the surf, you would have been looking for that 1,200 people to be out there doing cleanup.
I just wanted to mention one of the issues that we identify is the fact that we need a better way of mapping where sensitive wildlife are. One of the issues that came up was when the SAW volunteers wanted to go out and work the beaches and we were concerned about the impacts on wildlife. We tried to put together a map so that they could stay away from some of those sensitive areas, and we really didn't have the resources to do that. So that was one thing that we've included as one of the issues that needs to be resolved.
Okay. Very informative. I appreciate it. And we'll just hope the next time we have a lot better luck than the way this went. And part of that, I think, better luck will be the fact that maybe we can be a little bit more prepared. And in the sense of solving at least that one problem, and that is having a response vessel ready to go. And I hope, whatever we can do, time is a wasting in this session. But look at some sort of discussion and, seeing if that wouldn't be a problem. I have to be vague on that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Fisher?
One thing I was concerned, operating costs are probably high on a ship of that size, and there would be some obvious savings in staying close by and not being under cruise power and that kind of thing over a period of a day or 24 hours or something like that, rather than just running aimlessly around somewhere out in the ocean, having to wait and be prepared to come back. What does it actually cost to operate a ship per hour or something of that size in comparison to just being at anchor?
I can't tell you what the operating costs are. I can tell you what the daily rate costs for hiring a ship like that are. And they run around 22,000 of them a day. I would envision for in a readiness condition just maintaining the ship equipped, provisioned, fueled, and ready. And Salvage Chief, for instance, has operated her entire life on the coast, which is a very long time now, with there was a skeleton crew on board and others ready that can be called and available in a few hours. And I would see something like that as a practical and cost-effective way of maintaining that kind of capability.
And Mr. Chair, I think you misread my question. I'm talking about the new Clarissa itself coming and tying up rather and anchoring rather than going back out into the ocean and cruising.
Basically the fuel cost. And that's not a huge amount of money, but the margins in the shipping business are pretty narrow.
And it would be a saving though to tie up or to to anchor rather than...
If you say he's to anchor, if he's in port, he's got dock charges.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a trade-off.
I would imagine that, you know, anyone who might be looking at conditions... Pound low and cruise around offshore a little bit now. And that's good. I mean, we need those kind of thoughts in our mind.
Yeah. I don't know, but you know, that owner's still going to be talking to that captain saying, save us a dollar. Or, that's right, or you may be on your last trip.
I knew I provoked someone with that.
My name is Peter Richards, and I'm a citizen of Multnomah County, but I work for a shipping company. I'm sure the New Carissa's owners would have been happy to pay the difference in fuel to stay offshore and avoid the accident, and I know our vessels would be happy to do that, too. Bunker fuel runs about $180 a ton. That ship consumes about 28 tons a day. That would have been a minor cost. That's all I have to say.
Okay, was the New Carissa instructed to anchor, or was that a decision?
I have no idea what the facts are in this case.
Okay.
But I don't think the owner would be telling them to conserve fuel by anchoring. I don't think that would happen.
That wouldn't be the issue, yeah.
No.
Well, hopefully from this, we've learned something, because as was stated by our colleagues, we have seas that are famous. And talked with a friend of mine that used to, you know, do a lot of tug work, and anytime they had to leave the Columbia and head out to sea, there were always that fear. But I think the fear when the bow section was being towed is that, my gosh, if this thing goes down, it can take the tug, particularly in those kind of seas. So we're fortunate. It could have been a lot worse. And have the comedy of saying, oh my goodness, look, it's the ghost of the New Carissa as it approached Walport, and finding out it was that. Well, I want to thank all of you for taking the time to come in here. Some questions that I get asked regularly, I will be able to respond back, you know, more accurately than I have been able to, and we appreciate you very much. All right. If there's no further business to come between the two senators who remain, we will adjourn this meeting. The overview of the New Carissa grounding and the informational meeting will be closed.
There's more animals in. Throw back desert storm and stuff like that. Kids up here. Running all over. You got a few tackles. You don't find or birds and animals. It would be willing to pet all of it. Another one. 25 miles. Huh. Had a gallon. Hard enough. Yeah.